Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. We're going to start the show today by talking with you about mental illness in children. I'm Larry Mueller, and I saw a figure that stated that one in four children and teens experience a mental illness each year, but the signs of mental health problems can be hard to recognize. So I'm really happy to have as a guest today Dr. Jason Horowitz. Dr. Horowitz practices psychology at UW Health here in Madison. He's interested in depression, anxiety, behavioral disorders, and preventing mental health problems. He emphasizes mental health of children. So that's what we're going to deal with today. Has your child or maybe your grandchild experienced a mental illness? How do you respond to it? Did you experience mental illness yourself as a youngster? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and you can also post on our Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Dr. Jason Horowitz, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
How come, you know, I saw that figure, one in four. Is that true? How common is mental illness?
That figure does represent sort of our current knowledge about the frequency of these kinds of disorders. We have to recognize that not everyone will experience them at the same time, and that doesn't mean that 25% of people, of children, are all experiencing a disorder at the same time.
Okay.
But when you look at the trajectory across the developmental lifespan from birth to age 18, there is I think the best estimate is about that one in four children or adolescents will experience some kind of mental health problem during that time.
And I know that there are many kinds of mental health problems or types anyway. What disorders are most common for children to experience?
Well, there are a couple. Anxiety and depression are very common, especially as you get into adolescence. You see a big jump there as kids go through puberty and hit their adolescent years. Prior to that, it's, you know, relatively infrequent, like something like 2-4%. But recent research is showing that through high school, you know, about 20-25% of kids at some point will experience some kind of anxiety or depression. In younger kids, we see a lot of behavioral concerns. ADHD and other behavior disorders are probably the most common for prepubescent children.
Yeah. And so is this a sort of, does this present differently than you see in adults?
Yeah, it depends on the age. If you think of something like depression, we have an image of depression in adulthood that involves lethargy, lack of energy, lack of enjoyment in things, low mood. But in a young child, it may not look like that. A young child with depression is much more prone to be very irritable and angry at times. And you're not going to see those sort of long periods of sullen, withdrawn mood as much. But there is a lot of variability from child to child, so we have to kind of know where to look and how to ask the right questions.
Yeah. And, you know, on the parent side, I'm sure most parents are thinking, well, how can I make sure that this doesn't happen to my child?
Well, if there was a way to make sure it didn't happen, I'm sure we'd all be doing that. I think the most important advice that I give parents is to try to establish and maintain good communication with their children so that if the child develops a mental health concern of any kind, the parents will be aware of it, that the kids will be comfortable talking to their parents about things that are going on, and so they can respond in the most appropriate way possible. I think the real danger or difficulty comes when kids are experiencing things and not sharing with anybody, and the people around them are not aware of what's happening.
I'm thinking about, you know, my own daughter. I've got a 14-year-old daughter, and every once in a while she'll blow up about something or other. And I, you know, wondering, you know, what's the difference between mental illness and maybe what I'm hoping is the typical struggles of growing up in
sure.
her case?
Yeah, well, I think we have to be very careful not to pathologize normal human behavior. Everybody gets sad. Everybody gets anxious. Everybody gets angry. People misbehave. These are all normal parts of being a kid or an adolescent. We don't really start talking about these sorts of normal human experiences as disorders until they reach a level of severity that starts to disrupt normal life. If a kid gets nervous before a soccer game, that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
If they are so nervous before events that they can't go to things, that they start to withdraw, that they won't participate in things they used to enjoy, then we start to ask the question about, is this something that should be treated or addressed in some way?
Yeah, it makes some sense. Well, let's take some calls. By the way, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your own questions or comments concerning mental illness in children. John in Michigan up first. Let's go to him. Thanks, John, for calling. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind just comes down to nutrition and what I personally feel like the root of my own personal journey has been for an issue, because I've gone through mental issues that I've had diagnosed by physicians and doctors and used traditional pharmaceutical means to try to treat. And over time, I come to discover through plant physiology and bioavailable nutrition that's programmed into the soil by planting my own plants and eating my own food, I've been able to alleviate a lot of these conditions based on the fact that my gut, my gastrointestinal system, is no longer acidic. My pH levels are no longer out of whack and no longer creating a yeasty form of bacteria that seems to be feeding these sorts of conditions. It's just my perception, but I wanted to offer it.
Okay. And thanks, John, for calling. Comment on this. John's talking about nutrition as an issue.
Well, first, I'm glad that John has found his own solution to some of his own difficulties, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. I think that some of the basic needs of life, like sleep, nutrition, are those sorts of daily activities that we sometimes take for granted are really important. And there is some good evidence to show that children who are malnourished or chronically sleep deprived are much more at risk for developing behavioral and mental health problems. I would be hesitant to draw a direct line between mental illness and any specific nutritional supplement or aid, but I think those sorts of wellness issues are things that parents should be keeping in mind.
Yeah, thanks again, John, for calling. I want to give Cole a chance to join us from Platteville. Hi, Cole.
Hey. Hey, Larry. What's going on?
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
All right. I just wanted to mention that if you got a kid and they're going on a new medication, that you're going to want to watch them really closely, because I went in for depression and anxiety, which didn't end up being my issue. I have schizoaffective disorder, and the antidepressant I went on, I basically went completely insane, like psychotic on it, and did a bunch of things I'd rather not have done, spent all of my money, just a lot of bad things happened. So, I mean, just if your kid's going on a medication, just watch them really closely, make sure they're not losing it, basically.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Cole, for calling, and we're going to be even addressing even more the treatments for mental illness at 11:45 with our next guest. But comment on this, Dr. Horowitz.
Yeah, I think Cole makes a really good point. I would point out that side effects that like he experienced are not the norm for psychotropic medications, but they do occur. And when we talk about medication trials, There is a reason we call them trials. We don't know exactly what the effects will be, and I want to, put a caveat out there. I'm not a physician. I don't prescribe medications, but I obviously work with lots of kids who take medications. And he's absolutely right. When you're switching medications or starting medication, you need to be observed closely to make sure that there aren't those kinds of unwanted side effects, and that if they are, the treatment can be adjusted quickly.
Yeah. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at mental health illness in children with our guest today, Dr. Jason Horowitz. Really appreciate having him on, looking at how to learn to recognize and respond to mental illness in children. And certainly he can talk about common signs and causes of mental illness in children. And I, again, join in, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Mike in Green Bay up next. Mike, thanks for calling.
Hi. I've got a 12-year-old daughter with OCD, and I'm wondering different treatments. EMDR is recommended by one therapist. There's ERP, I think it is. And then medications, SSRIs. What are your thoughts on those?
First, talk about what is OCD?
OCD is a condition that involves obsessional thoughts that are very difficult to control, which often lead to compulsive behaviors, which then are also very difficult to control. I think, a common example that people might have had exposure to or be familiar with is compulsive hand washing, which often is preceded by obsessional thoughts about cleanliness and germs. But OCD, the kinds of thoughts that people experience and the kinds of behaviors that they might engage in can really vary widely. But it often has to do with the fear that something bad will happen unless they do this certain behavior. And there are a number of empirically supported treatments for OCD that have strong research background. Medication is one option, and there are effective medications for OCD. The caller referenced ERP, which stands for Exposure and Response Prevention, and that is the most supported behavioral treatment for OCD. And what that looks like, if we kind of take the example of someone who is really worried about germs and washes their hands compulsively to deal with that. What we do with kids with OCD is we create a ladder or a hierarchy of the things that they are scared to do or that they are unable to do because of these obsessional thoughts or would unable to do and then refrain from washing their hands or whatever the compulsion would be. And then we help them practice going through that ladder and working up the ladder without doing the compulsive behavior. And we try to break down the connection in their mind between this fear of germs and the need to do this behavior. And they learn that the anxiety that goes with that decreases over time, even without the compulsion, and they become more and more able to resist those urges and get back to kind of normal life.
How long does something like that take when you're working with someone? I suppose that's obviously depends on the person, but...
Yeah, of course, there's a lot of variability, but if I start working with a kid in a family where OCD is a presenting concern, and they ask me that question, I say, we should expect to work for 8 to 10 sessions, and by that point, we should be able to see some measurable improvement.
Thanks again for calling, Mike. I appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Dr. Jason Horowitz practices psychology at UW Health in Madison. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Louisa DeVogel, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Now we're taking a look at how to recognize and respond to mental illness in our children. With Dr. Jason Horowitz, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. And we'll take some calls. Let's go to Linda next, I think is next in line, from Sheboygan, Green Bay area. Linda, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the show and appreciate you. I wanted to know, I often hear us talking about treatments, and of course, we need the treat mental illness. And I also wonder about the bigger picture, what kind of research is being done on the social and cultural causes, and what can we do, what kind of action can we take in that realm?
Yeah, good question.
That's a great question. Thank you for that call. When we think about what contributes to mental illness, there are many factors that we have to consider. People have genetic or biological predispositions sometimes to develop certain illnesses. That doesn't mean that they're guaranteed to do so, but they may be more at risk than average. Certainly people's life experiences and the things they go through can contribute to mental illness. Traumatic experiences or chronic stressors put people at risk. And there is, I think, a wide understanding that in our culture, in our society, there are things that contribute to risk. If we think about maybe one aspect of culture, like media or social media, there are very strong demands being placed on adolescents through social media to be a certain way or to change who they are or to always be present and respond to social media. And the social stressors and the unfair or impossible demands placed on them can definitely be a trigger for developing things like depression and anxiety in adolescence. And there is research going on about the Facebook effect, or more broadly, how the increasing amount of time our kids are spending on social media is affecting their mental health.
Snapchat effect. I wonder about that one. My daughter uses Snapchat. Well, all of her friends do, and.
Yeah, and I think that, as a parent, it is impossible to shield your kids from social media. That will be part of our kids' lives as they go through adolescence. I think what's more important is that before they are on Facebook or Snapchat, you can tell that I'm old because I'm saying Facebook because all the kids are now on Instagram and Snapchat and things I probably don't even know the names of. But before they get engaged with that we as parents talk with them about what it is, how to use it safely, what the positive effects of it are and what the risks are in using social media, and that we have important and open communication with our kids about how they use it.
Thanks again, Linda, for calling. I want to give Jake and Madison a chance to join us, so let's go there. Hi, Jake. Thank you for calling.
So this is Jake from Eau Claire, and so then I worked as a registered nurse on a psychiatric unit for adolescents, and so they didn't get to go outside, and so I always thought that was a really important piece to their puzzle was, especially 12 to 18-year-olds, they need to go outside, run around, get some of that natural sunlight. If not, if their kids are spending a lot of time indoors, especially nowadays, I'm not a doctor, I'm not your doctor, but then, maybe check out a vitamin D prescription to help supplement that. And then also strongly encourage 3 to 4 servings of vegetables a day to give the kids and their bodies the building blocks they need to repair their bodies and then to promote normal growth. And then, go outside. And then another caller mentioned it, but, just being really aware of the side effects of some of these medications. Kids would arrive on the unit and they would just, the first thing the doctor would do would be double, triple their prescriptions. And, some of these drugs, 10% of the study candidates had reported increased suicidal ideation or suicide attempts. So some of these medications, some work for some people, some don't. Some can be dangerous. So, just being aware of that. And I'm just a big proponent of the holistic approach, the going outside, the eating the vegetables, the exercising. I'll take my comment off the air.
Yeah.
Well, Jake, first of all, thank you for the work that you do. That's a really, really difficult job, and we need people who are committed to that. But I agree with what Jake is saying. He's making a point about the sort of overall wellness things that we need to consider, including nutrition, exercise, sleep. Being a teenager is hard under the best of circumstances, and so we need to try to allow kids to be successful by attending to their most basic needs.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Tom in Burlington, it's your turn. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
I teach a voice, and I have discovered that 85% of the people who breathe simply do not breathe correctly. And seems to get overlooked. It's so something and so basic. But your lungs are shaped like a pear. The largest part of your lungs is it's the base of your lungs. And for 200 or 300 years, this concept of having the hourglass figure has done nothing but constrict the waistline where the belly should be going out. And you're exchanging your air that way. Some people are losing 10, 20, 30% of their air oxygen with every single breath they take. They put belts around the belly and they constrict it. They put tight diapers around these little kids. If you watch a kid in the crib, he breathes with his belly, and then they put these tight diapers on there, and the kid can't breathe. And then it affects so many parts of a child's life and a pregnant mother. women this problem with the baby brain syndrome. So I just wonder, have you guys really considered that? Is anybody concentrating on that? Are we going to do studies and look at the basic thing of breathing?
Interesting.
Tom brings up a really nice point. We breathing is important. And, you know, beyond just restrictive clothing, what we often see is that kids who get anxious or angry, their breathing changes when those emotions happen. And, you know, as you might imagine, when people get tense or agitated or anxious, their bodies tighten up. And exactly what he described happens. You start to breathe with just sort of the top part of your lungs. You don't get as much oxygen. It kind of contributes to your discomfort and can exacerbate those symptoms. And so breathing is part of behavioral treatment for those kinds of problems. And we do teach kids how to breathe in a way that helps them fill their lungs and feel more calm and relax. And so, you know, there is a lot of, if he's looking at for research, he might be interested in reading about mindfulness research with kids, where breathing is a big factor of that component of that approach, and is being shown to have good effects. So that I think was a nice point.
I was thinking about the broadcast classes that I teach here at the UW-Madison, and one of the things I spend a little bit of time on, especially early in the class, is how to breathe properly so that they have enough air to really finish the sentences that they're reading. And it's surprising, I think Tom's right, there are a lot of people that haven't learned how to or forgot how to learn to breathe properly. It's interesting. Thanks. Thank you very much, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. We have some open lines and get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Jenny emailed with a question about a situation her 7-year-old nephew had this past week. The 7-year-old son refused to go into Panera with her and his little brother. So he stood outside in the cold and was clearly in a panic. He told his mom he couldn't breathe. He was breathing fast and it scared her. After some time, she took him to the ER. Would you recommend a counselor for him in this situation? How important is it that his potential anxiety is addressed? Is it harmful, or is it something his parents could sort of blow off?
Well, I want to be very careful not to, make any assumptions about this situation or try to diagnose a situation or a kid that I have not seen. So I may hedge a little bit on talking about the specific kid. But when we are looking at, anxiety in kids in general, the question that we want to ask ourselves is this a pattern? Is this something that happened one time, but it was out of character? Is it a kid who's experiencing anxiety on a daily basis, who's needs a lot of reassurance, is very clingy? And so any parent has to make a judgment call for themselves as to, is this something that warrants attention? There's never any harm in, of course, talking to your doctor about what's going on and getting a professional opinion. And your doctor, maybe you only have one kid or two kids, but your doctor has seen hundreds and thousands, so they can put things in perspective. And if you describe what's going on to them, they can say, this sounds like something that warrants treatment or not.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much for that question. Justin emailed to ask how parents can tell the difference between autism spectrum disorder and other mental health disorders that may have similar outward symptoms?
That is a great question. We do have a specific diagnostic protocol for autism spectrum disorders called the ADOS protocol, and there are a number of providers in the Madison area that can do that. We do that at our clinic. The Waisman Center has a wonderful clinic that does that. There are other companies in the Madison area, including integrated developmental services, communication of innovations. I believe all of those places are doing ADOS protocols. And so if it's an unclear diagnostic picture, that is what you'd be looking for.
And this, I would assume that no matter where you live in the state, you're going to be able to find similar kinds of services.
Well, that's actually a really interesting issue. We don't have as many options when you start to get into more rural parts of the state for mental health diagnostics and treatment. And so we end up having people coming to our clinic from a pretty wide radius. That is something that is a real challenge for our field, and something that I think resources need to be put into, trying to make sure we have mental health providers in even less populated locations. I know that there's a lot going on right now within the UW system, considering options, including telemedicine and other sorts of ways of reaching out to communities where there isn't immediate access.
Let's take some more calls here. And let's see, who's up next? Is it Sherry? I'm trying to get Sherry. Sherry, hi, thanks for calling. Oh, I'm not getting Sherry up here. So let's try John. Also a little problems with our phones here. Let's go back to Sherry. Sherry, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a question about helping a young adult who is very paranoid accept mental health treatment or try mental health treatment when the paranoia keeps him from doing it.
Yeah.
That's a very difficult situation. With any sort of mental health treatment, the basis of the therapy is the relationship between the therapist and the client. And so for anyone really, having a good fit between the client and the therapist is integral to a successful outcome. I think that if a patient is hesitant to do something like trying medication, the first thing is to maybe try a couple of therapists and see if someone can make a connection to build that sort of rapport and trust that might open the door to other treatments down the road.
Yeah.
Well, so far I have not been, no one has been able to even get him to meet with a counselor.
No.
And he thinks that Western medicine is out to kill young black men.
Oh, boy.
I wonder if there's any sort of health professional that he does have a relationship with, a primary care doctor who might be able to kind of start that conversation with him.
Or someone in school? Maybe a
teacher? No, he's 22,
wow.
And he's not in school, and he's just been failing at everything, and it's just so hard to see such an intelligent, loving young man.
Yeah.
Go into such a horrible state of mind that he can't accept help or anything, and he just avoids all contact with authorities if possible, doesn't take care of himself, and we're all in the family afraid he's going to end up homeless.
Yeah. It's a sad thing, and about, as you were saying, Jason, there has to be someone who is close to him, probably, that's going to be able to carry the day eventually.
Yeah, it is, I don't want to, give, direct instructions about how to handle this particular individual. But what we often see people who have schizophrenia or other sorts of psychotic disorders is that a family approach where the entire family is involved is often what ends up being most successful, partly because that approach is able to achieve adherence to treatment in a way that is more successful than just working with an individual.
Yeah. Well, Sherry, I'm very sorry for the situation you're in. Thank you so much for calling, and I guess you just need to keep at it, doing the best you can. Al and Toma, we'll turn to you next. Al, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, Al here, driving through Wisconsin from Minnesota. I have two 15-year-old identical twin girls. This issue has been going on for several years now. And I guess my main question right now is, over the years, the girls have seen very delusional in some of their beliefs. But I've come to see, because I know them so well, that it seems like we've got a path that starts off with fear, moves into the anxiety, then moves into delusional talk, and then does it get into delusions. And if you hear them and you don't know them, you would say, well, that's delusional. But when you ask them in a certain manner, it sounds to me it's not delusions, but it's delusional talk. Is this a common thing? And I'll give you an example. They used to say that we're not their real parents. So when I take them to therapy, it's like, well, are you their real parents? I'd say, of course. But they would say that. But if you would ask them in a different way, say, as an example, did you drive here in your mom or dad's car, then they would recognize that, yeah, they're mom and dad. But they'll talk in a manner that I would call delusional talk.
Yeah.
Well, just so when we talk about delusions, what we're talking about is beliefs that are separate from reality. And when we refer to a delusion, the understanding is that person truly does believe that idea, even though that it's not real. And delusions can come in many different forms. Kids or teenagers or all people may say things that sound delusional, even if they are not delusional. There are lots of reasons why someone might say something. It might be, manipulative, or it might be calling for help, or it might be expressing some kind of emotion. And so I think, if I hear you right, I think the distinction you're making is saying things that aren't true, maybe to get some sort of effect, versus truly believing something that's not true. And I think those things would be handled in different ways by an experienced therapist.
Hmm. It's interesting that Al has talking about twins. Do you see behaviors exhibiting themselves with, like a pair of twins?
Sometimes. There are certainly, obviously twins share a lot of genetic material. And so there are higher rates for twins having the same sorts of personality traits, behavioral disorders as well, and physical traits. There is that sort of similarity, but that's not one-to-one. If you have a child with a certain physical or mental characteristic, a twin is certainly not guaranteed to have that same characteristic.
Yeah, very interesting. Al, thank you so much for calling. Adrian in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Adrian. Thanks for calling.
Hey there. My comment today, I realize the show is focusing on mental health and probably depression. I just wanted to point out, I think there's a significant correlation with teens nowadays and their online use. You've touched on this before. But from the minute they wake up in the morning to the minute they go to bed, if their parents are not actively policing what they're doing online, who they're with, who they're talking to, and I'm not just saying policing, I'm saying actually reading the social interchanges, the way people talk to each other, the things they say. The kids at school, they have this bring-your-own-device initiative. Schools are not able to police what the kids are doing on their phone all day long. The kids' brains are literally frying with constant contact and bombardment. And I just wish that parents and teachers and communities would all be way more involved and in their kids' business. And I don't just mean parenting them, but really getting into what it is that they're seeing, feeling, reading, watching. It's just, that's why there's so much of this increase in, I think, mental problems with teens.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Adrian. Comment from you, Jason.
I agree with Adrian that I think this whole social media thing is one of the great challenges of our day in raising children and teenagers. It's, you know, the kinds of things that they have to deal with on social media are, I guess they're not new. I mean, kids, when we were kids, people were still exposed to social pressures and bullying and all these other things. But you got to go home at the end of the day and didn't have to deal with it. Now yeah. It's a 24/7 thing, and if people are being mistreated online, it continues constantly. I think the intensity of the things that people say online is greater than what people are willing to say to each other face to face, and so the things that people can write can be really cruel. And I think that Adrian's best point is that the parent's role is to be involved and to act as a guide for how to use these things safely, how to enjoy social media without falling victim to the risks that are inherent there. And if we are involved with our kids in learning to use it, then they will be able to do so successfully.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. And Kathy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
I have two comments that may be relevant or may not. I haven't listened to your whole show. I just tuned in recently. But you had a caller that called in and the subject of autism spectrum disorder came up.
Yep.
And I wanted to point out that that is not a mental health condition. It is a neurological disorder. And many people with autism or Asperger's syndrome are, you know, fine and healthy mentally. And if they have a mental health challenge, it can be due to other things. But it is a neurological difference. And the other comment I wanted to make was that if people are struggling to find resources, either for personal mental health issues, or if they are a family member and concerned about a loved one or a friend, I would really encourage them strongly to contact NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI Wisconsin has a very strong state organization headquartered in Madison that supports chapters in practically every county in Madison, and they are just wonderful. I would really encourage people to check with them.
Thank you very much for calling, Kathy, and you're nodding in agreement on
NAMI. Yeah, absolutely.
NAMI
is a wonderful organization. They do incredible work, and I echo Kathy's sentiments.
Well, here we are out of time. That's probably a good place to close. NAMI is a good organization. Any others just off the top that...
None that jumped to mind. NAMI is a really great advocacy group, and I think it's a good resource for our community.
Well, I thank you so much for taking time to be with us, Dr. Jason Horowitz, and hope we have a chance to do this again. We're going to be continuing our discussion on mental health and taking a look at more in-depth on treatments. And again, Jason, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up, we'll take a look at treatments and finding the best treatments with our guest, Dr. Michael Peterson. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.